From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Tim Mak, senior correspondent for the Daily Beast, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. The Trump administration has put Iran, quote, on notice, unquote, that new economic sanctions may be imposed related to the country's recent ballistic missile test. In Washington, President Trump nominated a Colorado judge to fill the vacant seat on the Supreme Court, prompting a confirmation struggle with Democrats. Meanwhile, Democrats have intensified their opposition to Trump's nominees for the cabinet and his policies to reverse those of President Obama. And Trump's suspension of immigration from seven Muslim-majority countries continued to provoke protests. Tim, I'm going to start with you. Iran. I mean, this seems to be really picking up speed now that not only because Michael Flynn, the National Security Advisor, made this announcement that Iran is now on notice, but after that, on Friday morning, President Trump tweeted. And here's what he tweeted. He said, "Iran is playing with fire. They don't appreciate how kind President Obama was to them. Not me!" Exclamation point. That was Trump's punctuation. What about it?
Okay, so there seems to be a largely rhetorical escalation. When you say that Iran is on notice, that has no force in law. That doesn't mean anything from a military posture.
Well, they're talking about, I thought, that UN resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So what happened is Iran launched a ballistic missile, which, of course, is something that the Trump administration is strongly against. And it may be that by the time our listeners are listening to our conversation, there have been sanctions mm-hmm. that have been released on Iran. On Capitol Hill, I was talking to a lot of senators about this, and they say that they're encouraged by this new rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael, what about it?
I think there is a sense that in the international community as well, that Iran has been given maybe possibly a little bit of a pass, you know, mm-hmm. in years gone by during the Obama years, and that there's a need to sort of step up the vigilance and maybe put on a little pressure with increased sanctions, that sort of thing. And what's of interest to me is really who's making the decisions, who's in the room that's sort of guiding the principles of what's happening in the Middle East and what responses to take. And it seems more and more that Steve Bannon is the guiding force behind this, much more than maybe some of the security and defense advisors.
I'm going to disagree with you on Bannon, but we'll come back to that because this is a hardy perennial, I think, for Washington
Absolutely.
Journalism. But anyway, look, not that he's an insignificant figure there, but anyway, the threat, Tim, is the Iranians always threaten in these cases, new sanctions, we're going to pull out of the nuclear deal.
Right.
Is that similar to what Trump is saying? As you said, this escalation is largely rhetorical. That's just a part of that.
Right, but it could quickly slide into real action, right? Mm-hmm. If there are sanctions, Iran could pull out of the nuclear deal. It mm-hmm. could start, you know, hypothetically, it could start developing nuclear weapons. The United States could respond militarily, and the next thing you know, we're in a very serious conflict.
Well, if the U.S. responds militarily, indeed we
yeah.
would be.
The question is, how does the Trump administration expect this all to play out? Does it expect Iran to eventually back down mm-hmm. if it's bellicose enough?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that either, but it is a more dangerous road than the road that we were previously mm-hmm. on, mm-hmm. which was more diplomatic.
Mm-hmm. Michael, you want to add to this, or should we move on? I mean, my own view is Trump is letting the Iranians know that I'm a different guy from President Obama, as he said in that tweet. You know, he tended to, as you suggested, be not jump on the Iranians when they did something that appeared to violate the UN.
Yeah, I think you're right. That he's saying he's a different guy, and I think yeah. the Iranians are really trying to see. Well, let's see how different of yeah. a guy mm-hmm. that you actually are.
Yeah, we're gonna find out, and my guess is Donald Trump's gonna tweet a little more about this.
I would imagine.
He seems to like that. That's one of the, you know, you have to get up in covering the Trump White House. You got to get up early because there's, you know.
He's tweeting at 6:29 in the morning.
Indeed he is. Okay, let's turn to the Supreme Court. There's a seat that's been vacant since February a year ago. It was a seat that was held by Antonin Scalia, a conservative justice widely loved by conservatives, being one, because he was conservative, and two, because he was a very lively writer and witty, and his opinions were very interesting. And to replace him is a judge from Colorado. His name is Neil Gorsuch. His mother, actually, was in the Reagan administration, served as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, lasted only 22 months, wrote a book about how unpleasant Washington was. She had a terrible time. There were some controversies involving EPA. But here we have Neil Gorsuch. Trump made the most of it in an 8 p.m. East Room event where he announced that Neil Gorsuch was his nominee. What about it, Tim?
Well, you know, this is in a week fraught with controversy, with criticism from his own party on things like immigration and his refugee ban. Mm-hmm. This has been something that has really united the right, mm-hmm. that everyone from sort of the more populist right to the conservative right agrees mm-hmm. that this is a pretty conventional pick for a Republican presidential mm-hmm. candidate, that if we had, you know, President Mitt Romney or President Marco Rubio, we might have a very similar pick mm-hmm. as this.
Yeah,
And so what you have is people rallying behind Trump in a way that he hasn't had in the last 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. In a time of overwhelming controversy, he's managed to get at least a little bit of consensus mm-hmm. on the right. Now, the left, on the other hand, has kind of backed themselves into a corner on mm-hmm. this, right? I think a lot of senators would typically view this as a pretty acceptable candidate from a Republican president. But due to all the other controversy that has been generated by this White House, due to issues from immigration to refugee flow to possibly LGBT rights or any other things that the left opposes Trump on, there is a massive movement to resist Trump in any way possible and on every issue, to include the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So I think Democratic senators are going to have a very, very hard time, even if they had wished to be able to kind of support a nomination like this, not to detract from this nomination or oppose it and filibuster it and delay it.
Michael?
Tim is right. It's a conventional pick, and I would even call it a very professional pick. You know, it's mm-hmm. a very smart pick, and one that would have been done by any Republican, any conservative who had the White House. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, his credentials are impeccable. When you look at him as Columbia, he looks very much like Barack Obama, as a matter of fact. It seems like he was shadowing him with Columbia and Harvard Law in mm-hmm. his Harvard Law School class, Marshall Scholar at Oxford.
But Gorsuch went on to Oxford.
And there you go. And that's where, I mean, the resume is so bright you can barely look at it on a piece of paper.
I refer to people like that as overachievers.
Right. It's a high beam headlight of a resume. It shines like the sun.
Yeah.
So you sort of break this guy down into three sort of categories. You know, in terms of a nominee, certainly his credentials are impeccable. Mm-hmm. When you talk about him as a jurist, you have to look at his decisions that he's mm-hmm. made in the place where the liberals have the problems mm-hmm. with things like Hobby Lobby, where mm-hmm. he's prone to defend mm-hmm. Quote-unquote religious freedoms for businesses that want to discriminate on who they serve based on their own religious beliefs. And then you look at him in terms of him being a quote-unquote political football, because mm-hmm. not only is it the fact of Democrats trying to defend the principles that have been gained through the court over the last, let's say, 40, 50 years, it's the fact that Merrick Garland, mm-hmm. Who was nominated by President Obama, had a resume that even exceeded Gorsuch's. He was mm-hmm. roundly considered the most highly qualified jurist in the history of the Supreme Court to be nominated to the Supreme mm-hmm. Court, and he couldn't even get lunch mm-hmm. with the senators. Mm-hmm. And that was an injustice. And I think there's great pressure there is a great deal of pressure to exact revenge mm-hmm. for that. So not only mm-hmm. to criticize and to vet this candidate, but also to exact mm-hmm. some political revenge for what was done to Merrick Garland.
Do you really think it was, I mean, the New York Times in an editorial called it a stolen seat. On the
yes.
other hand, even the general counsel at the White House under Obama said if the roles were reversed, the Democrats would have done the same thing. They wouldn't have allowed a Republican to be nominated in the last year of a Republican president. You know, and even Chuck Schumer, who's now the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, and Joe Biden, who just left as vice president, have said the same thing.
Well, I disagree with you there, because okay. I think Anthony Kennedy was actually elected during the course. He was elected on November 11th. He was confirmed mm-hmm. to the court. In an election year. So, I mean, it can happen. It's happened before. Mm-hmm. That was for that Senate. And mm-hmm. the other thing that this points up, and we'll probably go into this more later in the show too, mm-hmm. is it really points up what's I'm really sad about, which is the dissolution and the disintegration of the culture of the Senate.
Yeah.
This is supposed to be an august body, the greatest deliberative body in the history of the world, the cool sauce, you know, that sort of calms down the House. Mm-hmm. And it's become the most partisan body. It's become the House. It's a place where you have strictly on partisan lines.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm really hoping doesn't happen, but probably will, is this candidate getting confirmed, Neil Gorsuch, by the nuclear option, which is it'll go 50-50, and then you have Mike Pence, president of the Senate, breaking the tie. I really hope that doesn't happen, but it looks like it will, and that leads to the complete disintegration of the culture of the Senate.
Well, you know, one of the reasons the Senate is, I agree with you on that, Michael, is because it, I mean, it's so close. I mean, you have 50 Republicans, 48 Democrats, and the House is, Republicans have a much bigger lead, and so the things are really heavily contested in the Senate. What do you make of this nomination in terms of passing, in terms of will you need to get rid of the filibuster to get him through? You know, there are already seven Democrats who have said, and this is not binding on them, Democratic senators, that they really don't want to have a filibuster against this nominee. Seven's not enough. You'd need eight. But, I mean, there's some question whether Democrats really want to go after a filibuster to try to block this nominee. I kind of doubt they do, but I have no inside information here.
So just for our listeners, I mean, traditionally what it requires is 60 votes in the Senate, 60 out of 100, in order to advance a nomination to confirm an individual to the Supreme Court. But however, the Senate can change its rules to make it a simple majority, and a vote of 51 will be sufficient. And as it happens, there are 52 Republicans in the Senate. So Republicans may try to change the rules in an unprecedented way, at least from a Supreme Court perspective, unprecedented
I think
way.
A filibuster would be unprecedented, too, of a Supreme Court justice, a nominee.
So what a filibuster would mean would be that Democrats would gum up the works and prevent the nomination from moving forward without 60 votes in support. This is probably more likely than not, based on what I was discussing earlier, that the left has backed itself into a corner, that so much of the Democratic Party base is disgusted with what has happened in Washington over the last 2 weeks alone under the Trump administration, and wants massive resistance from their senators. And if a senator picks up the phone in the morning, they're going to be shouted at by constituents from the time they get into the office to the time they leave about how they don't want the senator to confirm this justice without at least some delay and some resistance and questioning.
There are senators, though, there are Democratic senators, as you know, Michael, that there are 10 of them who will be running for re-election, or the seats will be open any if they don't. But in states that Trump won, and five of them are in states that Trump won by double digits.
Right.
And obviously Republicans would focus on those. They could make it difficult for them politically if they backed a filibuster.
I agree with that. And the other thing is, look, he is a qualified jurist. I don't believe in the litmus test thing. I think you should just take the qualifications. Yep. So that's my thing. Look, if he is confirmed for the court, you're back to where you have four solid liberals, four solid conservatives, and Chief Justice Anthony Kennedy in the middle deciding everything. Kennedy has said
he's not Chief Justice. He's a justice.
I jokingly call him that because he is the swing vote on every single issue.
Sorry, I missed that. Well, he is. You're right.
But if he has also said, I have heard through some people talking who would know that he has said that if this nominee is not given a vote, that he would resign from the court. He might retire. That leads to another Trump nomination, and then you have a solidly conservative court that changes everything.
It does, and it would be a much more contested confirmation for sure. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today, Michael Williams of CBS Radio and Tim Mack of the Daily Beast. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. You know, one of the things that impressed me about this, unlike, say, the immigration policy, which we'll get to in a minute, is how orderly the process of picking a Supreme Court justice has been. I mean, it goes back to this list that was first released, a list of conservative judges, you know, state Supreme Courts, federal courts, and so on, from which this list, President Trump, then a candidate, said he would choose the nominee from that list. And this really, I think, helped him in the campaign. He got a lot of conservative votes. Remember, there were a lot of conservatives who were not crazy about Donald Trump, for sure. I certainly know many of them in my own family. but in any case, they worked on it for many months, longer list came out in September, and then Trump himself interviewed four of these potential nominees and so on. It was a very deliberate and policy, not of this rushed into action thing and so on. And I think I'm about the only one who is giving Trump any credit for this.
No, I think he really deserves credit for it. Again, when you have this list, I think that, again, any conservative president would have chosen this man from the top of the list because of his qualifications. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very easy choice, and in a lot of ways a very good one. But again, he's created so much controversy and so much contention on all other fronts. It's very difficult to even give credit and give credence to the good decisions because of all the heat that's generated by some of the more questionable ones.
All right. Speaking of that, Democrats have also intensified their efforts to slow down or block Republican nominees for the cabinet. I wouldn't call it an unprecedented way. There are always some that are heavily contested. There seem to be more of them now that are contested, and they've delayed hearings and votes on confirmation and so on. What do you make of all this, Tim?
It goes back to the posture that we're going to see a lot of over the next 2 years. In many ways, I feel like we're already in the campaign season for 2018. You know, I mean, President Trump is already fundraising for 2020. Mm-hmm. He's raised $7 million as we sit here already. He's already filed a letter to run for re-election. We're in perpetual campaign mode. Mm. And I think Democrats understand that their base wants them to object as much as possible. We're seeing essentially what happened in 2010, the Tea Party movement happening now on the left. We're seeing a lot of folks dissatisfied with how their establishment is treating their base. That I'm not sure what this movement is going to turn into on the left. I don't know what it will be called in 2 years, but there are millions and millions of people out there who are angry with the Democratic Party and the way that they've acted. And what we're seeing is Democratic lawmakers, senators, standing up and blocking things in a way that, you know, 6-7 years ago, I think a lot of people on the left objected to how Tea Partiers and people on the right were blocking things.
One of the Democratic legislators, Michael, who has felt this heat from the base is the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York. You remember, it's only been a couple weeks ago, or maybe even less, that Schumer was talking about how we can get along, we can make some deals, and then he's not saying that anymore.
No, he's standing, with a megaphone in front of airports and the Supreme Court and that sort of thing. He's, I think it's sort of full on campaign mode, full on protest mode. You know, it's the '60s again. You know, in some ways. I do think, though, that for all of the commotion and for all of the tactical ploys that are being enacted and used by the Democrats, you see the great majority of these candidates going forward. They're advancing out of committee, and they're going to be approved on the floor because the Republicans have all the power. They just have the ability to do it. When you have the majority, you can change the rules to meet the situation, and that's exactly what they're doing. The Democrats didn't show up for meetings where confirmations were necessary out of the committee. Well, they changed the rules and said, well, just do it with who's here. And out they go from committee. I find it very funny, though, when you do have I guess the only candidate that really appears in danger is Betsy DeVos for education, because we've had a couple of Republican senators say that they will not vote for her. But by and large, they're going to get through. All the people that Trump has nominated have been pushed forward. They've been properly vetted. And, you know, the process is working. You know, it really is working.
Well, this is what usually happens.
It's what usually happens.
You get all your nominees to cabinet posts and other top posts confirmed, with maybe one exception. And Betsy DeVos, who's a woman from Michigan, a billionaire, who has been very active on education issues, but in a more supporting charter schools and school vouchers and things that Democrats oppose. Isn't that right, Tim?
Well, that's right, and you know what? She's going to get confirmed. It might be by the skin of her teeth. I mean, here's the situation. There are 52 Republicans in the Senate. She needs 51 votes. Two Republicans have already said, hey, we're not going to vote for her. So she has, 50 votes. A 50-50 vote tie in the Senate leads the vice president to break the tie. The vice president is obviously going to vote to confirm her, and that's what's going to happen. There isn't another Republican out there who's going to defect. And if there were, he or she would have said something by now.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to Trump's suspension of immigration from those seven Muslim-majority countries, which stirred protests in the U.S. and actually around the world. The protests have finally, after a week, have died down some, and this is only a temporary suspension. Where do you see this going? Michael, if anywhere, or just will last for a few months and go away.
I can't really imagine that this administration had anticipated the white-hot response to this document.
They
put it out. So in every way, as you look at the response to it from the public, from the government, from inside and outside the administration, and certainly with the media, in an administration that's clearly finding its way, and we have not a lot of institutional knowledge of government, mm-hmm. a lot of passion for what they're doing and for their cause, but not a lot of institutional knowledge. This may be among the most poorly planned, poorly communicated, and poorly executed efforts. It seems like it's the second year, but it's the third week.
Yeah, hard to argue with that.
Yeah, it really was. And look, the contentious parts of it override. I mean, there are some good things in it. If you actually read it, there are some really good things in there. They wanted, for example, impose studies of honor killings that have been perpetrated in the United States on women. And this is a good thing. How is that not a good thing? I mean, there are some good things in there. And I just want to have an honesty about what the policy actually is, because this is where the confusion lies. Some people say it's a ban. Some people say it isn't. Some people say this is about safety. Some people say it isn't. But if this is really about safety, make it clear and make the policies bear up to that. Let people who have visas and are legally allowed to come. All these things, clean it up. If it's about cultural purity, that'll come out. And that seems like at some level, it's as much about a cultural purity and disinviting certain constituencies from the country as it is about safety. That's the feeling anyway. That's what's generating these responses. People feel that sense of hypocrisy in this policy.
That's not my feeling, but then I wasn't protesting.
Exactly, and that's why you weren't out there.
I believe this is true, that only one of the seven countries, immigration from which it was suspended, Iran in particular, is among the 10 top population-wise countries with Muslims. I mean, you have a lot of countries like Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, Indonesia,
especially.
And so on. There are many of them. This is an argument. I'm repeating this because this is a justification used by the Trump administration that they really weren't focusing on Muslims in particular. They were focusing on countries that were very problematic in terms of terrorism.
Right. And there's no doubt that there's a serious threat of terrorism within those countries. But as a fact check, none of these seven countries have sent an immigrant to the United States that have conducted a single murder in the United States since 1975.
That's true.
So in over 40 years, there hasn't been a single immigrant from one of those countries that has represented a life and death threat to any American. So what do we have here? We have something that is clearly more about showing our intentions and creating a theater and sending a message than it is actually about national security within the United States. This executive order was written both too broadly and too specifically. It was too broad in the sense that it pushed out people who otherwise would be welcomed in the United States with open arms.
Yeah, people with green cards, for one.
People with green cards, people who are refugees and fleeing violence, and who are, by the way, the first victims of terrorism in these countries. Mm-hmm. And then it's also too specific in the sense that you mentioned, Fred, that it doesn't include a lot of countries where there are threats. Mm-hmm. And so the whole executive order, the whole ban on any immigration from any of these countries doesn't make a lot of sense from a rational perspective. It is largely meant to send a message. And what kind of message is that? I think it's a message that is easily hijacked by terrorists to say the United States hates Muslims. And in the future, it'll make it more difficult for Americans to find moderate Muslim allies to work with in order to extinguish the threat of militant groups. And it's going to make it more difficult to win the battle of hearts and minds in the future.
Michael, I was going to come back to the question of Steve Bannon, this White House advisor and in a very strategic position with President Trump. But we're not going to have time to talk about it. But there is this hardy perennial in journalism where reporters are always looking for somebody who they can say, well, that's the real power behind the president. And even, I forget who it was, maybe it was some magazine or newspaper referred to Steve Bannon as the de facto president. You know, and they said that about Dick Cheney. They said that about, they always find somebody in the White House who's really running things, and it's not the president. Anyway, we can talk about this at a later date, because this is an issue that will not go away, but that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tim Mak, senior correspondent for The Daily Beast, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.